everybody. This is Brad here on DotPaw Podcast, Stuff About Stuff. I wanted to take time and talk to my good friend Ed one-on-one. We've done a lot of things together, talked about a lot of stuff, some weird, some serious, and I wanted to drill down on a couple of things. Ed, do you want to have a brief introduction of who you are and what's up with you these days?
All right. Well, my name's Ed, as you know, and let's see. I've been retired from an engineering career now for since 2017. So I got lots of time on my hands, but I never have enough time to get things done. I ride a motorcycle. Used to ride a lot, and nowadays I just ride when it's nice out. And I'm also a current member of a volunteer fire department. What else? I'm married to a psychologist who is still working. And when she gets done working at the end of this school year, we're going to be moving to Texas.
All right. Yeah, that's pretty succinct. Thank you very much. So I want to talk about bikes, motorcycles. The joy in both of our lives. We both enjoy bikes. Ed's a little more of a mechanic than I am. I started riding again back when Ed and I lived in Southern California. He like reintroduced me to motorcycles. I had ridden motorcycles as a young man and kind of hung it up and done other things with cars. And then when I came back to Texas, I accelerated that, so to speak. So I want to talk to Ed about bikes. So Ed, why motorcycles? What's the deal with motorcycles and you?
Well, you know, Harley Davidson has a cliche. If I have to explain, you wouldn't understand, but I'll try to explain it the best I can. There's a sense of freedom and independence. And absence of consequence, because, you know, someday you're going to die and you're going to do the best you can not to, but it may happen now. It may happen tomorrow, may happen next year, may happen 10 years from now. And you have that kind of redemption from the daily burdens, let's call it, because you don't have those daily burdens when you're riding. You just have you and the landscape. And that's another thing that a lot of people who don't ride will have trouble understanding is when you're driving in a car through a beautiful area, the woods or the desert or wherever you like, you are looking at the woods and the desert and the ocean. When you're on a motorcycle, you are part of the woods and the desert and the ocean. You're engaged in the environment. You smell the smells. You feel the hot. You feel the cold. And it's a sensation that you really can't describe.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I agree with all of that. So, you know, you mentioned Harley Davidsons. I know you're a big Harley guy. Let's go back to your past in motorcycles. Have you always ridden Harleys, or how did you? What kind of bike did you start out on? And you know, was your dad? Did your dad ride? Give me a little history of your riding history.
Yeah, well, it wasn't always Harleys, but no, my parents didn't like motorcycles at all. They hated motorcycles. So I was pretty much sheltered from motorcycles all through my childhood and adolescence until I started growing my own wings at about 14. And I would run off with my buddy Jimmy and ride his motorcycle, which was a little 50cc Honda. And we'd go out in the woods and take turns riding around. And yeah, it was a lot of fun. And never told my parents because, you know, they would be very upset.
Yes, indeed.
And I'll tell you how anti-motorcycles they were. My mom was kind enough to buy two tickets to Woodstock. I lived in New Jersey, mm-hmm. and Woodstock was only about 2-hour drive from where I lived. So they thought it would be really cool for me and my cousin Frank, who had a driver's license, to go up and to this concert. And we had a 3-day pass. So if Frank could get off from work on Friday, we'd go up for Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Well, Frank showed up on Thursday night unannounced at my house. And it was a little drizzly out, kind of miserable day. And Frank showed up on his motorcycle. And he goes, "Aunt Millie, the New York State Thruway's rock solid log jammed. So the only way to get there is on the motorcycle." And she said, "Well, he's not getting on the motorcycle. He's not going." And she gave him both tickets, and off he went and picked up some hooker somewhere or something and went to Woodstock without me. Now, once in a lifetime opportunity. Then it got swallowed.
Wow. Wow. That's crazy. So Hondas, huh? Did you guys in New Jersey, or when you were young, did y'all have mini bikes? Did you do the whole mini bike thing and go-karts?
Yeah, I had a go-kart without a motor. It was, you know, steel frame
or
wheelbarrow wheels on it. And, you know, we tried to make a motor work on it with a piece of hose and, you know, did crazy things. And it was fun experimentation, but never really worked real well. But yeah, mini bikes were a thing. Again, my parents were very anti 2-wheeled motorized vehicles. Mm-hmm. So that fell into the motorcycle spectrum. And I really felt left out of, you know, all my friends were riding around the schoolyard behind our house and getting chased by the cops. And I wasn't one of them. And I kind of felt, you know, a little alienated because of it.
Yeah, because the police department didn't know your name or know your mini bike to chase. So, yeah, I can relate to that. Yeah, we had mini bikes and go-karts in Texas, and I had both. I had a mini bike and a go-kart, so I would ride the mini bike for a while, and then I would take the engine out of it and put the engine – I had one engine and two vehicles, and then I would put the engine on the go-kart, and you know, it's a Husqvarna chainsaw engine.
Oh, nice. I thought you weren't mechanically inclined. That sounds pretty mechanically inclined to transplant an engine.
You know, all you did was just unbolt it, you know, and take the chain off and then bolt it onto the thing and put the chain on. I can do that. That was pretty straightforward, you know. And then I changed the oil on it, and I would put new spark plugs in. But, you know, I'm talking about heads and, you know, knowing things and, you know, and then, you know, a mini bike, you know, a 2-stroke engine is one thing, but, you know, a V-twin is completely, you know, Kawasaki Heavy Industries makes a really complicated device. And I leave that up to the dudes that had the certifications and everything. So, so what was your first bike? What that was your bike, and how did you make that happen? And tell us a little bit about that experience.
Okay. Well, I was already married, and I worked full time, but I also had a part time job at a friend's gas station because he needed somebody to cover the night shift at the gas station. And he trusted me, and he was a fellow firefighter. So rather than driving my car down there, I bought a little 50cc Honda. I don't even remember exactly what it was, but it was a 2-stroke. Mm-hmm. And I jammed back and forth on that. Never had a driver's license for it. And, you know, I was a firefighter, so I could get away with a lot. And yeah, that was my first bike, and that lasted about 2 months, 3 months. And then, you know, I didn't work at Harold's anymore and kind of lost interest because I had kids and, you know, life took over. And then my first decent motorcycle was, believe it or not, a Kawasaki.
And, awesome.
And that was when I was in California already. So I didn't have a bike in Jersey. moved to California, bought this little Kawasaki, and it was too small to do anything with. So I ended up selling that real quick, probably 2 weeks, and because a friend of mine was selling a 360 Honda. So I would consider that my first real street bike. Now, before all this other, this all happened, I had several dirt bikes, one of which was a Boltaco Alpina 360. That thing was a beast. It would climb. I literally climbed over a steel case desk.
Wow. So,
yeah, that thing was a monster. Really quick. It was a trials bike, so you could bounce the thing around and do all.
Yes. I know trials bikes.
Yeah. Yeah, so back to the street bike. I rode that Honda 360 for a few years until I could afford something a little bigger, and I bought a 650 Yamaha. It was an XL 650. No, XS 650. Sorry about that. And that was actually a design that BSA did and sold it to Yamaha. But it was a backward shifting bike. So it had the shifter on the right side and the brake on the left when BSA built it.
Yeah, so, that's an English design then.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the Boltaco was that way too. But what Yamaha did was they reversed it. So they actually bored a hole or designed it with a hole through the block of the engine to put the shift lever on. And they made this little linkage to shift it on the right side, but with your left foot. And then the brakes, they just kind of mirror imaged it and went over to the right side. And I rode the snot out of that thing. I actually did, with my wife on the back, Jeannie at the time, we did 700 miles in one day. And that was a lot of miles with two people on that little bike.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's, that's. So when did the Harleys come into the picture? Because that's, you know, that's all I've ever known you to ride are Harleys. And, you know, you're kind of my go-to when I want to know anything about Harleys. You know, we were talking about the new Street Glide 2023 Street Glide yesterday, you know, and I love that bike, FYI. Road Glide, sorry. And I was, you know, just like, there's a gunmetal gray version of that.
Oh yeah.
It is beautiful. And
yeah, it looks like silly putty.
It is awesome. It's just an awesome bike. And every time I see them, I have a little bit of, you know, of bike envy there, but I get over it because I'm on a Vulcan. Everybody calm down.
I thought you were going to say something else.
So tell me about your heart. Tell me about Harley Davidson's and, you know, something, something old, something new and something blue.
Sure. Okay. Well, you know, I had several bikes between that Yamaha and my first Harley. One of them was a Goldwing. I really liked that bike, but I just ran the wheels off that thing too. Mm-hmm. But a friend of mine called me up and he said, "Hey, Ed, I got a buddy who is really hurting for money, and he has his dad's Harley, and it's only got 10,000 miles on it, and it was a 1989 Springer Softail." Mm. And he said, "There's some custom stuff on it that's kind of cool, and it was well taken care of. Are you interested?" I'm like, yeah, that's a really good price. So I went and looked at it. And my girlfriend, actually, at the time, loaned me the money to buy it. That was PJ. And and I actually did pay her back. But I was her driver. I drove her cars for her. I drove her motorcycle. I drove her her boat. So anyway, So that was my first Harley, and I put almost 250,000 miles on that bike.
Holy hell. Really?
Yeah, I rode that bike almost every day. It was in Southern California, so we had the weather for it.
Yeah.
And even in the rain, I rode it like down to San Diego. I did a lot of work down in San Diego.
Sure.
So I would do that trip like 3 times a week on the bike, round trip.
Gotcha.
So yeah, that adds up a lot of miles. And then when I took a weekend off or whatever, I would jump on the bike and go somewhere. And usually that was like 1,000 miles away. So yeah, it racked up a lot of miles. I put 80,000 miles on the first engine before it decided to erupt.
I like the way you put that, the first engine.
And then the second engine was actually I sent the first engine in to get rebuilt by Harley. They used to have this deal where for $1,200, they'll rebuild your engine to new specifications. So the engine got there and it was so bad, they just gave me a new engine with the same serial number on it.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's very cool.
But for $1,200. But, you know, that's not bad for a Harley engine.
No, it's not. No. Okay.
So,
all right.
So that engine went in, and I put another about 100,000 miles on that engine before it started to rattle and squeak and leak.
Wow.
And then sold the bike for $4,000. So I think I did okay.
Yeah, that's not bad at all. So when
so
did
it was
you,
under 200. It was about 180.
Yeah, so when did you move to the cruiser line of bikes, the, you know, quote-unquote bigger bikes? You know what I'm talking about.
Okay, well, the Springer Softail is a bigger bike. That's a full-size motor.
Yeah, I know, but I don't – bigger as in, you know
– Bagger?
Bagger, yes, thank you. Yes, thank you.
Okay, the bigger baggers.
Yeah, those the ones I love.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I was on the Springer when I moved to San Jose. And, you know, I keep my eye out for a good deal all the time. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy who owned a pawn shop who ended up collecting on a Harley. It was a Electroglide. I called it Big Red. And that was actually my favorite bike, second to the Springer.
I remember it. I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, but that was like $8,000 he wanted for that bike, and I was still riding the Springer.
Mm-hmm.
So I sold that to a friend for $4,000, and he was happy with that price because he got a pretty decent bike for that price and just needed to rebuild the engine again. Yeah. little did he know how many wheels have been on and off that bike. But I ended up buying that. That had like 25,000 miles on it. It was
not bad.
Not too bad, but a really good price. And I ended up putting a really good stereo system in it too and really cranked the tunes.
Mm-hmm.
But I lived in an apartment with underground parking with, you know, semi-secured. You had to have a clicker to get in.
Yeah.
And one day I go downstairs. You know, it was underneath my apartment. I went down there and I'm like, I wasn't drunk last night. I'm pretty sure I parked that bike here. So there were like 3 different places I would park the bike. One of them is the bike parking where I normally parked. And then there was an assigned parking spot that my dad's car was in, so I would move his car and put my bike behind it sometimes if there was no parking in the motorcycle
sure.
spot.
Gotcha.
And then the other spot was one of those, you know, got the yellow lines blocking it off because there's an access door. And, you know, I'd use that once in a while when I had to. But no, it wasn't in those 3 spots. So I came to the conclusion somebody stole my bike.
I remember that. I remember when all that went down and I was just scratching my head. What the F, you know? Mm-hmm. And that broke my heart.
It broke mine. I really liked that bike. But, you know, the insurance company paid for it.
There you go.
I got threw some extra money at it and bought a much newer, much bigger ultra classic electric bike.
Cool.
And that already had the high-end stereo and GPS and touchscreen and all that whiz bangs and a custom paint job and all of the Harley skull accoutrements you can find on the market were on this bike.
That one was red too, right?
No, that one was black.
And
that
bike black.
Yeah, that bike tried to kill me three times. And, you know, before I took delivery on the bike, I had Harley put low jack on it because it was going back in the same spot the red bike was. And, you know, professional thieves, you know, they know better ones coming along because of insurance. So, okay, I'm going to beat you at your own game. So, yeah, lo and behold, it got stolen, but the cops found it the next day, which was thanks to LoJack.
Yeah.
They only had like $1,200 to get it back to normal. I mean, they didn't even take stuff out of the saddlebags yet. So it was pretty decent. And, yeah, that bike tried to kill me three times, which is kind of interesting stories. The first time,
let's just do one of those. I want to stay on the positive side of riding bikes. you know, we've all been down, and if you haven't been down, you're going down. You know,
you know, only one time I was down on that bike.
Oh, okay.
The three times it tried to kill me, it failed.
Yeah.
Once the throttle stuck wide open, and
shit.
Yeah, that was a bad experience. And the second time was my own fault. Was in the rain when I was on an exit ramp, and it decided to hydroplane.
Mm-hmm.
I went 180 degrees. I had back tire was in front tire was in back, and I managed to get that back straightened out. I don't know how I did it. My guardian angel was watching over me. And then the third time was when I got rear-ended by another motorcycle at 50 plus miles an hour, and that kind of messed me up. It also totaled the bike. So in the end, I killed it. It didn't kill me.
Yeah. Having another bike hit you is a little. The cars are bad enough to have another motorcyclist hit you is a bunch of bullshit, if you ask me.
He was a rookie rider, and he had a tendency to for target fixation. So
yeah. Squirrels get killed like that.
Yeah, exactly. And deer.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, they walk out into the road and they see the headlights coming at them. Go.
Exactly. You know, but you know, people do that, and that's why you have to practice riding, and that's why you have to know what you're doing. It's not like getting into a car. You just don't jump on a bike and go. You got to make sure you know what you're doing. You know,
and you know, people think that that taking the Motorcycle Safety Foundation course makes them a motorcyclist.
And, no,
you know, my wife did that. She took the motorcycle safety course, and I said, "Well, congratulations! You now know how to ride a little bike in a parking lot."
Exactly. Yeah, all it does is help you get your license. You know, and that's all it does. But then you have to actually ride. You have to pay attention, and you have to practice things. You know, that's what I liked about Vernon so much. You know, he practiced with me. You know, and he taught me how to do things. And he goes, "You're gonna." I don't know if y'all had this out in California, but you see that? And I go, no, we didn't have that. We had like good roads. And he was just whatever he was trying to teach me that day. And he goes, look out for that shit, you know? And he would explain why and how to stay away from it and everything.
Yeah, armadillos don't do well under motorcycle wheels.
Yeah, no, they don't.
But neither do deer, and that's what I deal with up here.
Yeah. That's a thing here early in the mornings but that's a whole nother story. So I want to segue into motorcycle maintenance, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So, you know, the best advice for someone riding, long-term rider, short-term rider, what's the best advice for taking care of your bike? Do you have like three major points to hit for maintenance to keep you out of the $100 shop?
Okay. Yes and no. First is read the manual cover to cover. Mm-hmm. And included in the manual, surprisingly enough, is a maintenance schedule. And there's a reason they put that on paper.
Yeah.
One is to maintain your warranty if you bought a new bike, which mm-hmm. that's a real good idea to keep all your receipts. So, you know, if it says you need to change the oil at 500 miles and then 1,500 miles and then 5,000 miles, let's say, for instance. At 500 miles, you better be changing your own oil or having someone else do it. But if you change it yourself, keep the receipts and take a picture of your odometer with the receipt and just hang on to that. And do that each time you do any maintenance yourself, because then you have proof that you performed the proper maintenance on the bike.
Agreed.
In the event that something major goes wrong. So that's a good way to secure your warranty and do the work yourself. Now, changing the oil is not all that hard. Mm-hmm. You may need a tool or two. The tool to get the plug out from underneath. You'll need a basin to collect the oil in. You'll need an oil filter wrench to take the oil filter off. And some containers to dispose of the oil. Don't take it down to the ocean. That's not acceptable.
Oh, man.
Or pour it into your driveway or anything. And I got a story about that, but we'll let that go to another time. But, gas stations will take the oil for free. Or the place you bought the oil, like an auto parts store, they'll take the oil for free for recycling. Changing spark plugs is real easy. Nowadays, plugs are pre-gapped and they have a little sleeve over it so that when they ship it, it doesn't change the gap in the plug. So you can depend on that gap being pretty darn close to spec. So it's just unscrew the plug with a spark plug wrench and put the new one in. And never over torque it. That's a big no-no. And always start your screws and spark plugs and oil plugs and oil filters and all that with your fingers so that you're sure you get the threads right. Mm-hmm. If you cross thread, and it's easy to do on a spark plug, if you get it cross threaded because you tried to jam it in with a spark plug wrench and you just start ratcheting and all of a sudden it starts getting really, really hard to turn. Mm-hmm. So you put more muscle into it and then all of a sudden it goes, and it's real easy to turn because you stripped all the threads out. Now you got a big problem. Not unsolvable, yes, but it is a big problem. The way you fix that is, I would recommend taking that to a shop and they will drill it out to a slightly larger size and then tap it with a special tap to put a thing in there called a helicoil. That is basically got the inside threads of the spark plug and the outside threads of the hole he just tapped. Hey guys, hush. No, sorry about that.
It's okay.
He'll put that helicoil in, and they are very strong. It's actually stronger than the original aluminum threads. But, unless you're a machinist, I don't recommend you do that yourself.
Yeah, that sounds complicated to somebody like me. I don't do the spark plugs. I change the oil. I've done all that and all the other fluids is pretty easy to do. I stay away from the spark plugs. I let the Ma Ka shop handle that, and I just pay them. it's painful, but they got certifications on the wall and stuff, sure, and they take care of me. And the sweet ladies on the sales floor, buy me coffee and try to talk me into a new bike. So let's pivot to, I have to ask this question. This is a burning question. I know you've had a lot of rides. You've been on a lot of rides. You've known a lot of riders. You've been a lot of places. I'm aware of a lot of the rides, just for being your friend so long. And talking to you and hearing you talk to other people and some of the other people in our cloud of friendships have come and gone. The best ride and yet like the best ride and why, and you can say with who if you want to, and then where and what made it, you know, what made it the best ride? What, you know, what was the deal there?
Okay. The best ride was hands down. It was Chalk Ride. Chalk is Children's Hospital of Orange County. And a few days before Christmas, you know, remember we're in Orange County, California, so it's probably going to be about 80 degrees. But a few days before Christmas, they do a ride from one of the Harley dealerships. And they kind of ride around a little bit. You're following the leader. And they end up at the Chalk Hospital. And they fill the entire parking garage, parking out front, under the canopy. The only thing they don't fill is the emergency entrance. But the rest of everything paved has motorcycles on it. Well, that's a great ride just by itself. And admission to the ride, you know, most of those rides where you see lots of motorcycles, they're paying to ride. And they're paying for their passenger to ride with them. So, you know, it's normally about 15, 20 bucks for the driver and $10 or $15 for the passenger. So, you know, you're going, there's a couple bucks just to take part in this ride. But the admission to the Chalk Ride is two toys of a $10 or more value. So, and they should not be wrapped. And most guys strap them to their bikes when they're going up there. So you see all these toys on motorcycles, big stuffed bears with their arms flapping in the wind. And yeah, it's kind of comical.
Very cool. I think that's very cool. I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, but I went up there with PJ and Steve and his wife, and the girls had to go to the bathroom. So, okay. So we go up to the door and they said, sorry, we're not letting anybody in. And said, well, where are the bathrooms? Our girls have to use the restroom. I said, all right, just go down this way. But you guys stay in the lobby. I'm going to keep an eye on you. And, you know, it's this rent-a-cop with a badge and no gun. So, we're standing in the lobby and some gal comes up to us, really tall, attractive, 40 years oldish. She comes up and taps us both on the shoulder, kind of standing between us. And she goes, hey, can I ask you guys to do me a favor? It's like, what's that? She goes, I got a little boy upstairs that would love to meet a couple bikers. Could you guys come upstairs with me? I'm like, yes, of course. But would you mind waiting for our ladies to get out of the bathroom? And can they go up with us? Sure, that'd be fine. So we end up going up there. And guys that go on rides get pins that they keep on their vest or on their jacket to remember the ride by. So the Chalk Ride, they gave out pins. So we go up to the floor and there's this little boy sitting in a wheelchair. He's got a cannula in his nose, the oxygen, you know, that little tube thing, and white skull cap because he's bald, and he's in his gown, you know, his hospital gown, and he's got an IV attached to him, and he's out in the hallway, and says, "What's your name, dude?" He goes, "My name's Angel. What's your name?" I said, "I'm Special Ed, and this is Auto Man." And he goes, "Wow, it's really cool to meet you guys. And we shook his hand and he was like, he was just thrilled. He goes, can I see your motorcycles? And I said, yeah, we're going to have to go down to the end of the hallway. And I turned around to that woman who asked us to go up. I said, is it okay to go by the window? And she goes, yeah, sure. So she pushes him down to the window. And I said, now you see that canopy over there? Just to the right of it, there's a black bike. And it's got such and such on it. And then there's another bike next to it. It's got such and such on it. And he goes, yeah. I said, well, those are our bikes. And he goes, well, which black bike? Well, if you know anything about Harleys, 90% of them are black. So it was really hard for him to make it out. So the doctor said, hey, look, guys, he's kind of running out of gas here. So let's, I think we're going to have to wrap it up pretty soon. And I said, well, we're going to be leaving too. He said, but let me give you something to remember us by. And I gave him my chalk pen. Mm-hmm. So Steve gave him one of his pins too. And we tell him, look, you know, when we pull out, you see that brick area in the middle of the road? We'll stop in that brick area and we'll turn around and wave to you. Okay, so we do that and we stop in the brick area and we turn around and it's a mirrored building. Mm-hmm. So we're waving at him and it's like, so PJ goes, you know, it's kind of weird waving at, you know, something they can't see. I said, yeah, it's called faith.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. That's perfect. I remember that ride. I remember you telling me about it. I remember seeing it on the news and yeah, that's very cool. So I want to ask you about firefighting. I know nothing about firefighting except firefighters are involved. So why did you get involved with firefighting? What's the backstory with that?
Yeah, a bit of a backstory for sure.
Okay.
Many moons ago, my uncle was a firefighter. He was the chief at Colonia. As a matter of fact, he's still an officer in Colonia. He's been a member for 50 years.
Wow.
Yeah. So he talked my dad into joining the volunteer fire company. So I was about 15 years old at the time. And I was actually volunteering at a hospital. So my dad joins the fire company, gets all the training, and yada, yada, yada. And he asked me, you know, hey, one day you want to go talk to the guys in the first aid? Because they have a cadet squad that goes out on the rides with them. And, you know, they're kind of gophers. And you could join that at 16. Like, yeah, sure. So I went and talked to the chief and, or I guess, I don't remember. He was a captain. They call them captains in the first aid squad. And, you know, kind of did an interview and joined the first aid squad. I was a volunteer there for 2 years and got all my training done. What today's classification would be is an EMR. So it's an emergency medical responder, not an EMT or a paramedic. Anyway, I did that for 2 years. And then when I turned 18, which was at the time the drinking age in New Jersey, I joined the fire company because they had a rec room and our first aid squad didn't have a rec room. And in this rec room was a pool table and beer kegs.
Oh, here we go.
Here we go. So, yeah, I joined the fire department. Mostly for social reasons, but, you know, I wanted to do something with my community and I ended up really liking it and did a lot of training. Uh-huh. I'm actually a graduate of the New Jersey State Fire College. I have a diploma.
Wow.
And it's the equivalent of a certificate, a college certificate.
So let me ask you this. Are you a run into a burning, at the time, run into a burning building firefighter?
Yep. Yep. And wore a Scott air pack. I drove the fire trucks, ran the pumps. I did everything.
Wow. Yep. Wow.
So went up ladders and really high ladders.
Yeah. Okay, cool. Wow. Yeah, you got more chutzpah than I do, or some people say balls, so we'll just call it balls. Well, man, I running into a fire, a burning building is, you know, kind of like, you know, humans are like, I don't want to burn, and you would run the opposite way.
Yeah.
But I guess,
you know, the training kind of gets you over that because they don't just throw you into a burning building and hope you make it out.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, you learn different things. Like, for instance, the Scott air pack. They teach you how to put it on and take it off. That's actually a bit of a challenge.
Sure.
There's some controls on it, and you need to know how to use the controls and, you know, how to get a good seal on the mask, how to communicate when you have a mask on, because
so it's like scuba diving.
Exactly. And you're also in a quote smoky environment where you may not be able to see each other, so a lot of the communication is done by touch, which most people don't know. Firefighters stay within touching distance of each other when they go in as a team. You never go in alone. And then, you know, some of the training with a Scott, they take aluminum foil and they'll put it over your mask. And we did this with the Boy Scouts and had the Boy Scouts kind of spotted around the firehouse. And we had to go on our hands and knees and find these Boy Scouts because they were trapped kids in a burning building.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So you're on your hands and knees in your full gear, you know, your bunker gear. And you're searching for kids. So you got to start at the walls and find your way around. And, you know, you'd be surprised, no matter how well you know a building, you don't know it as well as you think you do when you're on your hands and knees and can't see.
Well, yeah, you know, that's a whole panic situation. The son of a gun's on fire.
Yeah.
And you're trying to save another human being and not get killed yourself.
Right.
So, yeah, you know, that's where you have to be trained not to panic and not to lose your cookies, you know.
Yeah.
And you have all that gear on, too, you know, the pants and the boots and the jacket and the gloves. And, you know, what always fascinated me about it was, you know, and you don't really appreciate this unless you've seen a fire or been up close to firefighters. You know, putting out a fire and what's involved in that, and the thought that's put into it, you know, spraying, it's not as simple as spraying water on it, and the velocity that the water comes out of that hose. It's not like, it's not like your kitchen sink or your, you know, you're setting in the backyard for a while. I had it.
It's all. Not your garden hose.
It's not a, it's like a Mondo hose, and it will give you a shit ton of water. And yeah, that's.
You'd be surprised how much thrust that thing has.
Oh yeah.
When we were at a drill, I'm volunteering with our local fire department up here in Whidbey Island. And, things are so different nowadays. I mean, amazingly different. The safety requirements and, you know, the protocols that they use are so advanced compared to what we did as volunteers in New Jersey, because it was, you know, 40 years ago. It was just different. We rode on the back of a fire truck. They don't do that anymore.
Oh, really?
Oh yeah, you'll never see a guy riding on the back anymore.
Oh, that's, you mean like on the back, like a ladder truck? They're not hanging off the back, like
right.
Yeah,
those are usually pumpers that they're on the back of, and there's a bar there, and you're holding onto the bar, standing on the tailboard.
You're
and
right.
Was,
I never
that was customary.
Yeah, I never see they're like in the truck now.
Right, right. Yeah, but you know there is a safety feature on. That tailboard is there's a button there, so if you fall off, you hit the button and the driver knows you fell off.
So he can stop it, they can stop and pick you up, put you in the ambulance. Which is very, that could be very handy. Let me ask you this, So I know, you know, everything is different now, and 40 years has passed. We were talking about, you and I were talking about this. I've seen this on the TV box twice now about electric cars catching on fire. And yeah, hang on a minute. Let me finish my question. And they pump 500 gallons of foam into it, and it still is on fire. And, you know, how they handle that. And you know what happened in Florida a couple of weeks ago?
Mm-hmm.
The Teslas are underwater, and when the water recedes, they burst into flames.
Yes.
And the guy was on the news the other day. He goes, "We just let them burn."
Yep. That's the current methodology. Is just keep the fire from lighting anything else on fire, but mm-hmm. let it burn to the ground. Because even if you think you got it out, it's going to come back.
Yeah, you can't put those out, you know.
And that's the same. Here's a really scary thought. Mm-hmm. You know, at least the car is out kind of in a area that you could protect, you know, on a road, let's say, or even on the side of the road, a victim of an automobile accident.
Sure.
You know, but you don't have a lot of buildings involved usually. They're pretty far away.
Mm-hmm.
But those batteries that they use in those cars are the same batteries they use in solar systems.
Yeah.
And that's in your house.
Yeah, those are just scary. You know, here in Texas, we call those carbecues, you know.
Yep.
Especially in the summertime. Matter of fact, a couple of months ago, I was eating lunch. I looked over the tollway, and there's just a car burning, you know, and a lady standing there, you know, hysterical. Her car just caught on fire and just started burning, mm-hmm. you know, and probably, you know, she hasn't been taken care of it, or, you know, hasn't been taken care of. And it just, the fire department shows up and they blow a bunch of water and it goes out, but the car is gone. If that would have been an electric car, you know, they would have closed the tollway on both sides and let that thing burn for like 6 hours.
It toxic fumes coming off of that. Those things are not real green.
No, they're not. Yeah, well, you know what?
That's another topic.
That's another thing. That's a whole nother thing. So, you know, what were you were telling me something I thought was interesting the other day. We were chatting about something. I forget what it was. Oh, yeah. So
I was in the green room.
Yeah, in the green. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We can use that term, in the green room. It was basically where, you know, now you're on an island now, and limited resources there for the fire department, and you have to get water. And you were telling me how they handle that now, because I've seen this done before where they'll, you know, pull up to, I lived out at a lake and a house caught on fire at the lake, and the fire department showed up in the little town I lived in, and they dropped the big ass hose into the lake. And they sucked mm-hmm. Pumped the lake water onto the house.
Right.
That was cool. But if you can't do that, you know, what's that? How do you guys do that now?
Okay. Well, that's called a hard suction line. That's the black hose that's on the side of the truck. Usually yes. on the right side of the truck,
because
they're used sometimes with a hydrant, but you have to kind of jockey the truck around because those hoses are pretty stiff, and they're stiff for a reason, so that when the truck is sucking water in, it doesn't collapse, because the other hoses are soft and they'll just go flat. So, we can't suck water out of the Puget Sound because it's got salt in it, and that will destroy the truck. And those are multi-million dollar machines. You don't want to be drinking those.
Exactly.
So we have a thing called a porta pond, and it's basically about a 3 foot deep, 20 foot by 20 foot swimming pool that's got an aluminum frame, and it's folded up on the side of a truck we call a tender. So what we do is we set up this little porta pond, and the pumper truck, that's the normal fire truck that you see with the black hoses on the side, Mm-hmm. We'll put one of those black hoses into that porta pond. And while we're setting this up, those pumpers have usually about 1,500 gallons of water on board. Some smaller, but today's standards about 1,500. But if you're running 100 gallons a minute, that means you got 15 minutes of water and it's gone. So in that 15 minutes, you got to get this set up, this little pond, and get the hard suction line set up in it. And then the tender truck that brought that thing is also kind of a mini tanker. And he carries 3,000 gallons of water. And that pond, he carries 2,500 gallons of water. And that pond holds 3,000. So he'll dump his whole load into that pond so that now you have about 30 minutes runtime. And within that 30 minutes, you've got to go out to the hydrant with the tender and fill the tender back up and then bring it back and dump it back in the pond.
So that type of situation is where the fire trucks can't, there's no hydrant near the,
right.
There's
no hydrants. There's no lake. There's no pond.
No helicopters swooping in to drop down.
Well, you know, they don't use helicopters on structure fires either. So if you've got a barn burning in the middle of a big farm, probably in deep cuckoo.
Yeah. You know, that's a big thing here too. A lot of, old school, farms that are still in Plano and, you know, North Texas, you'll just see something one night going, oh, I guess someone's having a party and the barn is burning down. Mm-hmm. They just let them burn. Now, a lot of them have horses in them, you know, they rescue the horses, obviously, and but that's that. This has been very interesting. I think we need to do a part two, to tell you the truth.
Sure.
I'm going to... thank you, Ed, for this part one, and I'll publish part one, and then we'll come back with part two, and we'll pick up with that because I have more firefighting questions, believe it or not. what's up with that bear? What's his deal? You know, come on now. You know, I know you and I were in Lincoln County,
there's a story behind that.
I know. We saw where the bear was, and we were in Lincoln County.
Oh, that's right. Yes, we did.
I know, and I was like, oh, the dude, there really is, because I thought all that was like Yellowstone. I thought all of that was made up, you know, and I was like, what the hell? And that, oh, that's real. So we'll talk about all that.
Hey, and Mr. Ranger.
So, and then I would like to segue back into bikes to end part two. And then I think we'll be done talking to each other for a while.
Okay. Well,
so I'm
going... never get tired of you, Brad. So, you know.
There'll be an extra $20 in the green room for you, sir.
There you go.
You know, and it could be possibly American money. So I'm going to stop the recording now. Do not hang up on me so I can speak to you. And thank you, Ed. I really appreciate it. And thank your lovely wife for allowing you some time to talk to your nerdy little friend. And
she's working. She doesn't know this is happening.
Never mind. All right, man. So I'll see you in part two.
Okay. See you in part two. And thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, sir. Thank you.